Our fourth case for this morning is Harris against Hardy. And we'll hear from Ms. Penson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Geneva Penson. I represent Mr. James Harris, who is an Illinois prisoner. Mr. Harris, in his brief, has argued three claims, two of which pertain to his claim under Batson v. Kentucky that the prosecutor used peremptory challenges to exclude black people from the veneer. And the third claim, which relates to his claim under Brady v. Maryland, that the state violated his right to due process by failing to disclose medical records which could have refuted the testimony of the state's prominent witness in aggravation at his sentencing hearing.
Benson, let me begin with a question that really requires us to step back. In this case, Mr. Harris, as I understand it, is one of the people who was originally sentenced to the death penalty, and then former Governor Ryan commuted his sentence, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Natural life.
That's correct.
Should you prevail on your Batson claim and win a new trial for him, he could get the death penalty again. Now, is he aware of this risk, because it's a very important, to me anyway, it's a very important aspect of this case.
He would take the position in state court that if he prevailed on his Batson claim, he would not be eligible for a death sentence again.
Well, this court has held otherwise. Now, maybe the state courts would take a different view of Illinois law, but should he fail in the state courts and come back here again, we actually have decided cases where we've drawn a distinction between, on the one hand, a situation where somebody is tried and the state seeks the death penalty and then the death penalty is not chosen by the jury. At that point, the death penalty is off the table, of course. But in the executive clemency situation, which we've seen more than once, as a result of former Governor Ryan's actions, we have said that on a retrial there could be a new death sentence. So, again, you know, that's just us, the federal courts, but it seems to be a momentous decision to make, because should he be reconvicted and should a new jury conclude that this was a particularly brutal set of circumstances, he could be worse off by winning than by leaving things alone.
On the Batson claim, under Your Honor's interpretation, yes, that is true. But he would take the position in state court that he could not be resentenced under state law to death.
That's our point. Has he been told about the risk? Because this is something, you know, you want it to be his decision, and you also want to be protected from your standpoint. I mean, so it's not something you have to necessarily, I mean, if you can answer that you've discussed all this with him and you're comfortable with that, that's fine. Otherwise, certainly when we're done with this oral argument, you need to discuss it with him and get something in writing about his position.
Oh, yeah. No, we'd be happy to give you some period of time, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever you need.
To make sure he wants to pursue it, you know, given those risks and that you've gone over those possible risks with you, because we can't give you a guarantee.
Sure, yes. I'd appreciate that. Actually, I will speak with him regarding your position after this oral argument. I would like some
If you
time
can just file a letter, we'll say within 2 weeks, and if that turns out not to be enough, you can notify us and we'll reconsider.
Okay, I will do that. I would like to focus today, however, on Mr. Harris's Brady claim.
Brady, and so, but can we go back to Batson for
sure,
a minute?
Sure, yes.
Because I don't have a clear sense. What was the size of the jury pool and the racial composition of the jury pool? I mean, I know about what you've already identified.
Right. There is, there were at least there were at least I'd say 50 people questioned during voir dire. And the record, the state court record is not clear exactly on the size of the jury pool and the number of black people in the veneer, but there were at least 60 people questioned during jury selection, probably many more that we can identify. At least 60. And prosecutor used, I'm sorry.
And you don't have any sense in the record, isn't any clear on what was the racial composition of the jury pool?
No.
So who would you single out? I want to stay with the Batson issue for a minute, too.
Okay.
Who would you single out, and I'm certainly not asking you to waive anybody else, but as the most glaring instances of intentional discrimination from your perspective?
Okay. From Mr. Harris's perspective, I would single out, I believe, Christine Riley, who actually was included in the ineffective assistance claim, but Christine Riley as the most glaring instance of discrimination during jury selection. Ms. Riley, the prosecutor said that he excluded her because she was divorced and because her nephew had been stabbed in a fight a few months or weeks earlier. However, side-by-side comparison of Ms. Riley with people, actually white people, actually seated on the jury, showed that the prosecutor failed to apply these same concerns to those jurors. Ann Folan, for example, was seated on the jury.
Now, there was a factual question about...
Was she the one that was divorced?
She was divorced, yes. And also Teresa Nadjowski was also divorced. Yet the prosecutor had no objection to allowing them to be seated on the jury.
And then Richard Gray, Maureen Ring, Lois Gregg, and Norma Peacock indicated they or family members had been victims of crimes. And the prosecutor didn't know the disposition of those cases.
That's correct. I think the prosecutor knew the disposition of two of those cases, but not all of them.
But the prosecutor didn't ask the white prospective jurors whether the victims were actually implicated in the crime as perpetrators.
No, the prosecutor didn't ask that. The prosecutor had no concerns with the white jurors who had been victimized or had family members who had been victimized, whether or not they had actually been offenders. I mean, that was never a concern raised with white jurors. That was raised with Christine Riley, who was black, and also with Betty Simmons, the prosecutor. She stated that her son had been the victim of a robbery, and the prosecutor excluded her from the jury for that reason, saying that he did not know the disposition of the robbery case against her son. It is very telling, I think, that it's only when the potential jurors are black that the prosecutor has additional concerns about them being victimized or family members being victimized. I mean, in Christine Riley's case, the prosecutor seemed to conjure up, is the word that I would use, some sort of plot on Riley's part to hide the true status of her nephew. The prosecutor thought her nephew was an offender, even though he was the one who had been stabbed. That's very telling in my point of view. You were asking if there was some factual question about whether or not, I believe you were asking about Ann Folan.
I wanted to ask, I thought there was some, reading the state's brief and reading yours, some question about the timing of when Ann Folan was seated. The state says, well, it was after the peremptories were exhausted, and I recall that you thought otherwise, so if you could explore that a bit.
Absolutely. The state says that Ann Folan, that the prosecutor had no chance to use its peremptory challenges on Ann Folan. And it's true that the Illinois Supreme Court made that factual finding as well. That is a clearly erroneous factual finding by the Illinois courts. I mean, the record indicates that Ann Folan was questioned in the same panel as another juror by the name of Robert Allen. And this can be found at volume 4 of the supplemental transcript on, pages 48 and again on pages 313 to 14. The state exercised its 20th, I'm sorry, she was questioned in the same panel as Robert Allen, and after both Allen and Folan were questioned, they retired to chambers where the parties decided which jurors they wanted to strike, how they were going to exercise their challenges. It's at that point that the state exercised its final peremptory challenge to exclude Robert Allen from the jury. It certainly had an opportunity to exclude Folan. One would think that if they were so concerned about a juror being divorced, that they would have done that, but they did not choose to do that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish that. Now.
I think that that's significant not only for this issue of divorce, but the prosecutor also excluded two other jurors because they were teachers or their wives were teachers. That's Wilbert Stern and Milton Pickett. Ann Folan was not only divorced, but she was also a teacher. So she had two qualities that the prosecutor claimed to find objectionable in jurors, yet they seated Ann Folan on the jury with no objection. And certainly they had an opportunity to strike her, but chose not to do so.
Now, what about this Edward Shealy? He worked at a law firm and had friends who were lawyers, and yet Teresa Nadowski, Richard Gray, and Michael Dolan had friends or family members who were lawyers. Were there follow-up questions by the prosecutors on those three jurors?
No.
There were follow-ups, though, on Edward Shealy. Is that correct?
Well, the court did the questioning in this case, and the court did ask Mr. Shealy whether or not he had discussed their work, the lawyer's work or their law enforcement philosophy with the lawyers he knew and worked with. And he said no. The prosecutor found that unbelievable. However, the prosecutor had the opportunity to ask these follow-up questions of Gray, Dolan, and Najosky, and never did that.
So the judge just put the question to everyone, do you have friends that are lawyers? The other three jurors answered yes. There was no follow-up by the prosecutor.
That's correct.
But
yes,
there was follow-up
with Mr. Shealy.
That's
yes.
So
that's
Mr.
correct.
Shealy's job was an administrative one, right? He wasn't a lawyer.
He was not a lawyer. He was a docket manager at a law firm. He did say during jury selection that, you know, he didn't know anything about the cases. He was just a docket manager. He didn't know anything about the cases, didn't talk about the cases. He was not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that additional side-by-side comparison is relevant to Mr. Harris's Batson claim as well. Lucille Woodard, for example, is a veneer person who was excluded by the prosecutor. He said because she was divorced, again, but there were other people on the jury who were divorced and the prosecutor had no objection.
I thought she was the one, though, that the Illinois courts say, well, actually, they just didn't get around to doing anything with her at the end of the day when she was questioned, and so they just decided to keep her in. They just decided to get rid of her because they couldn't remember anything about her beginning of the next day?
That is one of the explanations that the prosecutor offered for excusing Woodard as well, that he didn't know anything about her. She had, like you said, been questioned the day before and was asked to come back the next morning to continue jury selection.
To use up one of his peremptories and take his luck on the new day's panel?
What he said was he couldn't remember anything about her. Under Batson, the prosecutor has to give a reasonably specific reason for striking a juror, not just, you know, there's nothing about her that I can really think of that's objectionable, but I'm going to strike her anyway.
Missing elements in her card, no information regarding the ex-husband where he had been employed. Her neighborhood was basically the same area where the incident took place. She was one of the very last jurors to be questioned that day, if not the last one.
Yes. That was after he said he didn't really know what he found objectionable about her, but then he continued to describe her responses and on her jury card and during voir dire. As far as her age being blank on the jury card, certainly, again, that's something that the prosecutor could have inquired about, even if he had to put that question to the judge. And as far as her residence, I believe you said was close to the crime scene. I think her statement was that she lived on the south side of Chicago, which, you know, I believe was she lived 3.5 miles from the crime scene, I believe, which on the south side of Chicago is not, you know, is not close. It's not close. It's a densely populated area, and it just, it's not a correct characterization of her response.
Okay, your time has run out, but I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal after the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Erica Seaburn from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. May it please the Court. I would like to start by discussing Ann Folan, because there is a factual dispute about the record here. The voir dire transcript reveals why the State used its final peremptory strike on Robert Allen instead of Ann Folan, because Robert Allen testified that his brother-in-law was incarcerated at Joliet. He'd been there for several years. Mr. Allen had visited his brother-in-law in prison. He knew the circumstances of the crime and testified that, in terms of bias, he leaned towards his brother-in-law.
But you don't want to confuse peremptories with challenges for cause. If they had a challenge for cause for Mr. Allen, they could have used that and wouldn't have consumed a peremptory. It was still a choice, as frequently is the case with peremptories, the lesser of two evils.
It was, but this wasn't a challenge for cause, and the State used...
That's my point. I mean, if the State is looking at the package, it could have equally struck Ms. Folan and left Mr. Allen on.
Yes, but it's also the State's use of the strike on Robert Allen is consistent with the way that it struck other jurors. There were two other jurors.
Well, that's not the question. The question really is, could they, if the reasons they gave for the strikes of the African Americans were valid reasons, then they would have struck Folan, because she met those criteria. In fact, they don't strike Folan. They choose to strike Allen.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it necessarily follows that because they struck these other jurors, because they were teachers, that the only way that they can show that this wasn't pretextual is to strike Ann Folan. The State only had one peremptory challenge remaining.
Well, but,
and
but
they had to make a choice.
You're trying to show that not a single one of these people was struck for racially discriminatory reasons, and there are actually several of them where the explanations border on the preposterous.
So, like, if we give you the one who had the brother in Statesville, what about Wilbert Stern, who was a former teacher and married to a teacher, and Milton Pickett, who was married to a teacher, and Ann Folan was a teacher, and Teresa Nadowski was a former teacher? They're on Stern and Pickett, aren't they? The peremptories were exercised against them.
Yes, they were, but I would argue that the reason that Ann Folan got kept was because Robert Allen had to be decided on first, and he had a brother-in-law in prison. And
okay, so I'm just looking, though, at other people.
Mm-hmm.
Same Ann Folan was a teacher. Wilbert Stern was a former teacher married to a teacher. He got struck. He was black. Milton Pickett was struck. He was married to a teacher. And Teresa Nadowski was a former teacher. She's on. He's off. What's the difference?
Well,
they don't have, this isn't a situation where Stern and Pickett have brothers or relatives at Stateville.
No, they don't. I was referring to other jurors,
right,
who are not part of the staff
challenge.
That's
what I was saying. I'll give you those. Let's get to these others.
All right. Well, with Wilbert Stern, the main reason that he was stricken was because he was a former teacher who had changed careers for...
To get a better paying job? Since when is that a fishy thing to do?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it was clear. I don't think Mr. Stern put his salary information into the record. I think that was just the assumption that he would have changed careers to make more money. But
that's really a terrible thing.
Without the additional information, the prosecutor didn't know why it was that career change had been made.
None of the white jurors were asked about career changes? They'd all stayed in the same job forever?
I think Mr. Franks made clear that one of the aspects that he was looking for in jurors was people who had had very stable careers, people who had been in the same job for many years.
He had a long career in the blue-collar job that he took. He'd been there, I think, 15 years or something, wasn't it?
Yes, but he'd still had a somewhat unusual career change. Now, it may have been because he wanted to earn more money, but we just don't know. And in terms of whether or not the prosecutor could have found out this information, the trial court made a very specific finding during the Batson hearing that the court had conducted all of the questioning, that either side could have offered follow-up questions, but neither side did because it wasn't common practice at the time. Now, nowadays, in the aftermath of Batson, it's much more common for prosecutors and defense attorneys to either conduct their own voir dire or to submit additional questions. But in 1984, before Batson even came out, the trial court found it wasn't common to do follow-up questioning. So the lack of information is on the trial court. It's not on Mr. Franks. Mr. Franks had a limited record to work with.
Let me back up a minute and say, as we know, Batson is a case that concerns not only the jury that a particular defendant gets, but it also concerns the public interest in a jury process from a fair cross-section of the community. And so whether the state actor was the state trial judge or whether the state actor was the prosecutor, in the final analysis doesn't make any difference. If the process that the state provided to Mr. Harris, was racially discriminatory, then there's a problem under Batson, period. I don't think it makes any difference who was asking the questions.
Well, Your Honor, I think in order to find that, you would have to make some sort of finding that the trial court had conducted questioning in such a way to deliberately provide more information.
Provide the factual substrate, and then what we're looking at is the reasons that the prosecutor gave for removing certain people and comparing those people to the white people who wind up being on the jury, when it looks like there's a very good match between the blacks who are struck and the whites who sit, that raises a strong inference of discrimination.
Your Honor, I would say that any information as to that is not sufficient to overcome the state court's determination under AEDPA. This court ruled last year in Mahaffey that the court's not going to reverse on habeas just because it might decide the case differently in the first instance.
When the state fails properly to apply the standards set forth by the Supreme Court, then it's our duty to apply the law.
Yes, but that we are reviewing the last state court decision on the merits, which would be the Illinois Supreme Court.
And if the Illinois Supreme Court has made a patently wrong decision based on the state court's own record, that's one potential problem. And if the Illinois Supreme Court fails to see that somebody was the victim of discrimination, I mean, occasionally these writs are granted. AEDPA is not an impossible standard. It's just a high one.
It's not impossible, but I would argue that petitioner simply hasn't met it here.
So if a prosecutor strikes possible jury members because they live in a predominantly black neighborhood, isn't the prosecutor using the neighborhood as a proxy for race? Or couldn't it be used or viewed as a proxy for race, just saying they live in this neighborhood?
Certainly it is possible that that could happen. However, the trial court here specifically found Mr. Franks credible. And under Batson in footnote 21, the Supreme Court states essentially that in Batson, the determination largely turns on credibility. In Hernandez, they said that the best evidence of whether or not discrimination has taken place is the prosecutor's demeanor. This court has applied the same standard over and over again.
So even the juror who lived 3.5 miles from the crime scene, the general South Side, is enough to strike him?
Well, I believe that's a reference to S.E. Taylor.
Right.
And I believe that I think it's important to note that both sides were actually in error about how far Ms. Taylor actually lived from the crime scene. The prosecutor had thought that it was about 10 blocks based on the numbers of the, I believe it was 71st Street and 61st Street. The defense attorney during the Batson hearing thought that it was between 10 and 20 blocks. So, yes, it was a mistake, but I think the fact that both sides made it indicates that it's an honest mistake. And this court and the Supreme Court's precedent is clear that what matters is the prosecutor's honesty, not necessarily his accuracy.
So what justifies assuming that only black people who are victims of crime might really be offenders?
Let's talk about Christine Riley. Okay. The point of Christine Riley was not what made her different from the other jurors who said that they had family members who had been crime victims is that the way that Christine Riley described the situation gave rise to a reasonable inference that maybe he wasn't an innocent victim. She didn't just say, my nephew was stabbed. She said, he was stabbed in a fight outside of his house. I don't know exactly what happened. He was in the hospital for a week. She never went to visit him. She didn't know how that case was being disposed of. Now, none of those other jurors who said that they had family members who were victims of crime or were, you know, victims of crime themselves talked about the crime in a way that made it less than clear that they were the victim of the crime.
So what did they say, these other jurors?
Well, something that they would
Gray,
say.
Ring, Greg, and Peacock.
I believe Mr. Gray had had an apartment burgled. Ms. Ring's husband had been mugged in their backyard. It's possible that I have her mixed
Greg
up with Norma Peacock.
Peacock.
Yes,
most
but it's
Greg and Norma Peacock.
One moment, please, Your Honor. All right. Mr. Gray's apartment was burgled. Sorry, Mrs. Gregg's husband was mugged in their backyard. Mrs. Ring was the victim. She was the victim of an attempted assault 21 years before, and Mrs. Peacock stated that her car had been stolen. So in none of those instances was this the sort of crime where you could have any question after that description as to who the victim really was. But Ms. Rowley described her nephew being stabbed and then said it was in a fight. She doesn't know what happened. She didn't know whether her nephew was the instigator. She didn't know what the ultimate outcome of that case was going to be. I'd also like to...
I can't let this go by without commenting that the prosecutor's bias against people who live in Hyde Park is pretty remarkable, I have to say.
Well, Your Honor, I think Mr. Franks was pretty open about the fact that he did have a certain prejudice against Hyde Parkers, but there's no evidence that it was pretextual. He said that that was based on his experience in jury selection. And the trial court made a specific finding that Hyde Park was actually a very racially integrated area. So it's not possible that you could even say that Hyde Park is a pretext for race.
Yeah, good thing I wasn't on Mr. Frank's potential panel, since I live in Hyde Park.
Yes, apparently Mr. Franks would have assumed that you were artsy and intellectual.
Right.
But then again, you are...
It struck me from the jury, clearly.
Well, you're also a federal judge. I think that probably would have come into play as well.
Not at all. Our chief judge sat on a jury in Cook County some time ago.
Clearly, that jury was not selected by Mr. Franks.
Clearly.
Or somebody else was on the jury that there was a stronger reason to strike.
Yes. Prosecutors have to make comparative choices, particularly at the end of the panel.
That's why I'm not... too impressed with the idea that the decision was made to strike Allen instead.
Well, Your Honor, the trial court also made a finding that it's his experience during jury selection that both sides tend to be more aggressive at the beginning, and then by the end they tend to have run out of strikes too early, and then they have to be suddenly become more choosy when they get down to their last strike.
Does the state have a position on the question that I began with, Ms. Penson? Should Mr. Harris prevail? Is it the state's practice to seek the death penalty again?
Your Honor, I couldn't answer for the state's attorney of Cook County as to whether or not they would choose to seek the death penalty at this point. I think legally speaking, they could.
Okay.
But I certainly can't speak for them. If the court wants that sort of information, we could...
No, I'm trying to get it as a matter of law. It's the position of the state of Illinois or the Cook County State's Attorney's Office that it is within their authority to seek the death penalty again.
Yes, I believe that the law states that if Mr. Harris got a new trial as a result of a Batson violation, then he could conceivably get the death penalty again. If the court just gave him a new sentencing hearing based on Brady, then the death penalty would be off the table because of the commutation. In terms of the racial composition of the jury, which was brought up earlier, by my count, and this isn't definitive, 61 people were examined in veneer. There were 21 African Americans. The defense excluded one. Two sat on the jury panel. One sat as an alternate, and then there were 17 struck by the state. I would also like to briefly address Lisa Lucas. Juror who was stricken because of her demeanor. The trial court recognized that demeanor explanations have to be scrutinized very carefully. But here, there's actually excellent evidence that this was not a pretextual reason. Mr. Franks testified that the notes that he took during jury selection in 1984 said she looked meek and sleepy. That's at page 180 of the petitioner's separate appendix. That evidence is contemporaneous with jury selection, so that's actually very good evidence that Lisa Lucas actually was meek and sleepy and that her demeanor was not something that Mr. Franks came up with after the fact to try and justify the strike. Petitioner also argues that the demeanor explanation is either controlled or persuaded by Snyder versus Louisiana. But Snyder is factually distinguishable from this case in a very important way. Here, the trial court made a specific credibility determination that he thought that Mr. Franks was candid and that he believed that Mr. Franks was telling the truth. In Snyder, the real problem, as this court recognized in the similar case of U.S. versus McMath, was that the Snyder trial court left a total void in the record as to why he was accepting the challenge. The prosecutor offered two potential reasons, one of which was demeanor-based, and then the trial court just said, all right, I'm allowing the challenge. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, that's not sufficient. You haven't provided us with enough of a record. Here, the trial court did provide enough of a record, so Snyder certainly doesn't control this case, and it's not even persuasive that the Lisa Lucas explanation was pretextual. In terms of Lucille Woodard, she was the juror where Mr. Franks stated that he didn't remember much about her at the Batson hearing and that he thought he had probably stricken her because she was questioned at the end of the first day, but she was still in the panel.
That's completely contrary
day.
To what you just said, because it seems like he was willing to just waste a peremptory on her, even though she might have been comparatively far better than some of the other people the second day.
Well, she was more towards the beginning of the jury selection. I believe she was the eighth peremptory strike that he used, so he still had a number of peremptories. So that would fit with the trial court's finding that prosecutors tend to be more... It's strange to me, too. I'm a much more cautious person than Mr. Franks is, but...
Possibly pretextual, you know. Oh, I just struck her because I felt like it because I didn't remember.
Well, Your Honor, that was actually part of the trial court's credibility determination. The trial court specifically said that one of the reasons he believed Mr. Franks was because he thought Mr. Franks was being honest about what he did remember and what he didn't remember. We certainly want prosecutors to be candid in these Batson hearings, and we don't want them to try to make up reasons because they think that if they say that they honestly don't remember something, that someone's going to find that that's pretextual. Given the circumstances here, and it's objectively verifiable that she was questioned at the end of the first day and still on the panel on the second day after 11 newer jurors had been stricken, it wasn't unreasonable for the Illinois Supreme Court to find that this explanation was not pretextual.
All right. Well,
the court has no other questions?
No.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And your time did run out, but I said I'd give you a minute for rebuttal, Ms. Benson.
Regarding the prosecutor's strike of Robert Allen, obviously the prosecutor did not articulate his reason for striking Mr. Allen, and the record does show that Mr. Allen's brother-in-law was in prison. However, Mr. Allen said that he only met his brother-in-law one time. He visited him in prison with his wife one time, and whatever happened that his brother-in-law did happened before Mr. Allen even met his wife. In fact, Mr. Allen, when asked, thought he might be overly harsh on the defense, but he could put that aside and be fair to both parties. So this record does not show that that Ann Folan would have been any better of a juror than Mr. Allen, and the prosecutor certainly could have used that strike against Ms. Folan, who had these objectionable characteristics in the prosecutor's mind. Also, regarding Christine Riley, the state explained that she was the only juror who gave an explanation where her victimized nephew could have been the offender. But what does that say about Betty Simmons? I mean, she also had a family member who was a crime victim, and she was a black juror stricken for that reason, a black veneer person stricken for that reason. However, there are still several white people who were seated on the jury who were either victimized or had family members who were victimized. The prosecutor voiced no objection to that. Again, the prosecutor may not have asked questions, but certainly the prosecutor had the opportunity to submit questions to the judge. I cannot give you a specific citation to the record right now, but the judge was giving the prosecutors, both parties, the opportunity during jury selection to submit questions for further inquiry.
Okay, so we'll expect to hear from you in 2 weeks about your client's wishes with respect to this case.
You will hear from me within 2 weeks, okay?
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.